You can have a seat. My name is Brandon. I'm one of the pastors here, and so thankful that you chose to join us today. If it's your first time, welcome. If it's your 98th time, we're glad you are here as well. Listen, if you have a Bible, you could turn to Exodus chapter 3. So we're just picking up where we left off last week, Exodus chapter 3. I'm obsessed with finding the most efficient way to get from point A to point B. I don't know if anybody's with me. I love maps. I got this thing for maps. I think it started when I was pretty young. And so I actually don't trust Waze or Apple Maps or Google Maps. I think that I can beat the algorithm. For some reason in my brain, like I think if I look at the map and I can plot my own course, that I can discover the fastest, most efficient way to get from point A to point B, even more so than any system or algorithm or app, like I can do it. And it drives Kristen crazy. Because the turn-by-turn directions don't work for me. And so we'll be driving somewhere, and I'm like plugging the address in while I'm driving, right? And I'm looking at the map because I don't care what it says, and I'm like trying to pinch it and expand it, and I'm like doing the whole thing. She's like, she's very polite as I'm swerving all over the road trying to look at my map, and politely she'll say, can I help you with something? Like, can I do that for you? I'm like, no, you cannot, as a matter of fact. This is something that I need to do on my own, right? I want to do this. So coming back from Christmas with my parents, we're coming up 75 headed north, and traffic started to back up. And so I pulled out Waze, and I saw there's an accident ahead, so I just pulled off at the next exit because I can beat the system, right? Like, I know how to get around the traffic. And so I get off the exit, I take a right, and then I take a left. We go down this long road, and then something in the back of my mind, I was like, wait a second, have I done this before? Maybe. No big deal, right? So we get to the end of that road, take a left, right, back on 75 and cruising. And then as soon as we got back on 75, I remembered I had done this before. See, sometimes this necessity to find my own way, to create my own detour, so to speak, works out like it did just last month. But there was a time about a year before that, maybe 2 years before that, where I did the same exact thing, except for I didn't make a right turn and a left turn. I made a right turn, and then a right turn, and then a left turn, and then a right turn, and then a left turn, and then a left turn, and then I was on a dirt road. And so we're just cruising on my detour on the dirt road, and Kristen's like, are you sure you know where you're going? I'm like, babe, listen, I got this. I know exactly where we are. And in the back of my mind, every man has been there before. I'm freaking out because I have no idea where we are and I have no idea where this dirt road leads. And I'm replaying like scenes from like terrible old like movies where like I am leading my family into the jaws of death, right? The banjos are going to start to play. The whole deliverance thing is going to happen. But I'm cool and calm and collected. I know I got it. I got it. So we cruise down this dirt road for what seems like forever, finally end up back on the highway, take a couple of turns, get back to the interstate, we're okay. It was not the most efficient way possible. I hate the long way, the detour. When you get to the sign and you realize the road's closed, you have to go around. I hate it. Even more so maybe in life. I don't know if you've ever experienced a detour in your life. But the direction you thought, the interstate you thought was carrying you where you wanted to be, and you had to get off, you had to stop, you had to change direction. And all of a sudden you're like, what am I doing here? Maybe this will be foreign to some of you, but when you get to your mid to late 30s, you start to have those sorts of thoughts where you go, man, I took the long way. You look around at guys that graduated with college or high school who are succeeding and doing great things, and you're like, man, I'm just stuck on the detour. And this place is exactly where we find Moses. You might remember what happened last time we were together is that Moses felt a burden for his people, the Hebrews. And even though he had grown up in the house of Pharaoh, who is oppressing the Hebrews, he realized his own nationality. He realized this was his people. He was burdened for them and wanted to free them. But he took these matters into his own hands and ended up committing a murder. And in doing so, he lost the respect of the Hebrew people he was trying to lead. And not only that, but made himself a marked man with Pharaoh. And so he fled. And where we pick up the story today, Moses has now made a home of his detour. Now the back road is where he lives. And we'll see him with his own family out in the wilderness tending sheep. So if you got a Bible, you got your Bible app, you got it memorized, you got a scroll, whatever you got, pull it out. We'll put it on the screen too. We'll pick up Exodus 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock with his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he, that's Moses, looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said to him, this is God speaking, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Here is Moses on this life detour. This is not where he thought he was going to end up. He thought he was going to lead his people. He was going to be a champion. Instead, he's a shepherd in the middle of nowhere. And he sees this bush burning but not consumed, and it captures his attention. Verse 3 says, he turned aside. Now, that just seems maybe like, for us, like he just kind of turned around. But in the Hebrew, the idea is that it's possibly on the other side of a ravine, or he has to go a separate way. He has to work to get there. In other words, what just happened is Moses has to take a micro detour in the middle of his macro detour. That in order for him to encounter God in this burning bush, not only is he in the middle of nowhere, not where he's expected, but he's going to have to go to turn aside and look and see what's happening here. And then God speaks. And God says, this is who I am. I'm the God of your father. When you're growing up in your own home, those first 3 or 4 years of your life, I'm that God that your dad told you stories about. And I'm the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And that doesn't mean the God of old. That means the God of covenant promises. The God who made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God who's about to make those promises come true. So verse 7. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. Does that sound familiar? It's last week, right? The God who hears, remembers, sees, and knows. Verse 8, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me. I have seen their oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. God says, I've heard my people's cries. I know the situation they're in. Now, you remember this whole time, that God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, that's two promises, you remember that? A promise of a great nation, a great people. We've already seen that in the text, that despite the oppression of Pharaoh, that the people of Israel continue to multiply and grow stronger. And now God says, now I'm going to keep my promise of a great land. And I'm going to deliver them from slavery into the land that I promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And God said in verse 12, he said, I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Verse 13, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And God also said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. So first, let's ask this question. What does this passage have to teach us about God? What can we learn about the God that interacts with Moses on this detour? What do we know about him? The first thing is this imagery of fire, this burning bush that isn't consumed. One, it's an amazing miracle, draws Moses' attention and pulls him over to see what this bush is. It could be on fire but not being consumed. We'll see all the way through the book of Exodus that this imagery of fire is a way that God continually chooses to reveal himself. In fact, when we meet God again in the story on Mount Sinai, there will be fire. And when God is leading the people out of Egypt, we'll see fire. And even at the Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea, we're going to see this fire again. But what does it mean? Why is this a medium through which God is revealing himself? Because fire is both inviting and absolutely terrifying. Fire is inviting. It draws us in. It's warm. Now, depending on how many degrees away from middle school you are, your fascination with fire decreases, right? The closer to middle school you get, fascination with fire increases. Further away you get, decreases a little bit. So every Halloween, we want to make sure we have an opportunity to meet our neighbors. We love Halloween, by the way, not because we love like ghosts and goblins and Satan or whatever else, but because we love our neighbors. And it's the only time in all the year when my neighbors come to my house and they're excited to see me. Right? Like, that's it. And so we want to be as welcoming as possible. And so we bring candy out to the street. We set up games. We'll have cornhole. We'll do hot chocolate. And we'll do a fire in a fire pit. Now, I would love to believe that my neighbors stick around and talk to us because of my warm and inviting personality. But the reality is, I think it's the fire. That for some reason, especially this last year when it was pretty cold, like people just want to gather around. Something about fire and the human experience is inviting, draws us in. What an amazing feeling when you walk into a home and there's a fire in the fireplace. It's inviting. It's also terrifying. Because if you move that fire in the fireplace 2 feet out into the living room, then that's not warm and inviting. That's a major problem. I read some studies about the human reaction to fire, especially when fire is out of control, and we are terrified. Basically, let me just sum up these studies for you like this. People freak out. That's what happens. When something catches on fire, people absolutely freak out. It's terrifying. This fire consumes everything in its path. You can't control it. You can't put your arms around it. And this imagery of God as a fire, it's this balance of who God is, where he is both simultaneously inviting us in to know him and then reminding us that he is radically different from who we are. Now, this is not the God that we typically want. In the marketplace of gods, especially here in the United States, where you can kind of pick or create your own, typically God is either one or the other. He is this terrifying, demanding, lethal God. This God who's convenient for those who are in power. The self-righteous love this God who demands judgment and comes with condemnation. You can get that. A God of picket signs, screaming hate. Or there's the God who invites, who's warm, who will never tell you there's spinach in your teeth, never correct you for any sort of wrong. A God that just brings you in. This God of moral license who doesn't want to change you at all, just wants to love you. But the God of the Bible is both at the same time, both demanding and a righteous judge, and inviting and warm, offering forgiveness and grace. The God of the Bible is a fire, not willing to be parked in one or the other category, but full of both. And this is a problem for a lot of us. The reality is, this is a problem for a lot of us who grew up in the Bible Belt going to church. Because in our churches in the Bible Belt, in reaction to previous generations only talking about the demanding, terrifying God, what we got was only this overcorrection of the inviting and warm God. And so we struggle with it. In our current culture, it's not people who don't know Jesus, who didn't grow up in church, who are deconstructing our Christian faith to result to only this one inviting, warm aspect of God. It's people who grew up in church, who are reacting against too much in one hand or too much in the other. But that's not the God that we see in the Scripture. Blaise Pascal is a philosopher, mathematician, who lived in the 17th century and is brilliant. When he died, what they found, felt something in his jacket pocket, the jacket that he was wearing. There was something strange, not in the pocket, actually in the lining. And so they unstitched it, and it pulled out a tattered letter that it was so important to him that he had stitched it inside the lining of his jacket. He never wanted to forget it. This is what it said. The year of grace, 1654, Monday, 23 November, from 10:30 at night until 12:30, and then in bold letters, just fire. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Not of the philosophers and of the learned. Certitude, certitude, feeling, joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ. And then the rest of the page is just sentence fragments of a man wildly trying to scribble down and remember what happened in this moment where he met God, the God of fire. And the only way he could describe that spiritual experience was quickly writing down fire. God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. So Moses wants some more clarity. The picture of fire is not enough. So God calls him on a mission. And then what we see in verses 13 and 14, Moses says, hey man, this mission, this is great. I'm glad you called me, but here's the problem. When I show up, if I show up to these people, who am I even going to tell them that you are? And God responds and says, you tell them this. You tell them I am who I am. That this is my name, God says, forever. This is the way I'm going to be remembered. That this God of fire has a name, and his name is I am who I am. We usually, in our English Bibles, make sure, note that name, I am who I am, by using Lord, all capitals. In the Hebrew, it's Yahweh, God's personal name. Really just the verb to be. What's really going on here, even though we translated I am who I am, a better way to put it is like this, I be who I be. You want to know who I am? I be who I be. I am who I am. I get to define myself. No one else defines me. And just like fire, when you interact with me, I am who I am. I shape you. You don't shape me. All kinds of metaphors here. God could have described himself as water. And you and I could pour that water into a cup and we could shape it. And God could have described himself as wood. And you and I could have gotten out tools of carving and we could have shaped him. God could have described himself as clay and we could mold him with our hands. But God described himself as fire. I am who I am. You don't shape me. I shape you. I am who I have always been. I am consistent and unchanging through the past. I am who I am in this present moment, and I will be who I will be into the future, the same. I am what matters in the past. I am what connects you to your fathers. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am what you need in this very moment, and I am what gives you hope for the future. God's name, he says, is I am who I am, not I am who you want me to be. You see, Moses is pushing back. He's standing here on holy ground, sandals off, not wanting to receive direction from God. And God responds, no, that's not who I am. You don't direct me. You don't define me. See, man, I'm like a fire. I shape what I touch. I am who I am. That's my name. And that's how you are going to know me forever. God is self-defining, which is a struggle for us. You go to any coffee shop, sit down at Starbucks, you order your mocha or your frappuccino, whatever you're going to get. You sit down with someone. You strike up a religious conversation with somebody. What happens? Let me tell you who I think God is. And God's like, no, man, it's not the way this works. I tell you who I am. I define myself. I reveal myself. So what does this passage then teach us about us? If we see clearly that God is both inviting and terrifying, the fullness of all of that, we see that God is not defined by us, but he's self-defining. We know God based on the way he reveals himself to us. If we see that God is I am who I am, that he's not who we long for him to be, what does that teach us about us? Well, early in the passage, Moses asks a question. He says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Now, what you might expect is for God then at this point to give him a self-esteem talk. For God to go, who are you? You're the guy. You remember? You're the guy who got rescued from the Nile, the crazy miracle in the basket, and you were found by Pharaoh's daughter. You're the guy. You remember, you're the guy. You get the Hebrews. You grew up in your parents' house until you were 3 or 4. You know the stories about God. You're the guy. You got a first-class education from Pharaoh. You're the guy. You were trained to be a leader. You're a guy. You have a burden for the people. You're the guy. God doesn't mention Moses at all. He just says, I'm with you. That's it. You want to know who you are? All you need to know, Moses, is I am is with you. I am. The God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who keeps his promises, the God of covenant faithfulness, the God of love and mercy, the God that you don't want to get too close to, who's an all-consuming fire, the God who I'm about to show you, Moses, is more powerful than the most powerful man on the face of the planet. So I don't need to give you a pep talk, he says to Moses. I don't need to make you feel better about yourself. What you need to know is I'm going with you. You see, God is self-defining, but we're not. And I want to slow down here because that might be the most offensive thing I've ever said to you. If you don't catch what I just said, you're going to miss the whole main idea. God is self-defining. We're not. You go, Brandon, why would that be offensive? I don't know if you live in the same Western, postmodern culture that I live in, but we are bent on defining our own identity independent from any other source. This whole thing that we live in is crafted so that you and I could develop an identity for ourselves with zero input from anyone else. We live in a system, in a culture that is fiercely devoted to the right to define ourselves in any manner that we see fit. And you and I spend most of our lives and energy trying to craft these identities, define ourselves. That might be for some of you college students, this period of time where you are finding yourself. It might be for some of you who are already into your career, making a job change. But we found and latch our identities onto all sorts of things. And in Exodus chapter 3, God's saying, no, man, you don't get to define yourself. Who you are is not the most important part of this equation. You define yourself rightly in light of who I am. See, the problem that we're seeing with this fight to answer the question, who am I, by filling in our own blanks instead of latching our identity to the God of the universe, is it is exhausting. And it fills us with anxiety and dread. And it is overwhelming and crushing and leads us into lives that lack certainty. And we realize these identities are eroding around us, that we can't be these people we've crafted. We can never in actuality live up to this online version of ourselves that we edited. That we can never in actuality be the type of employee that we pretend to be. And so then we just jump. Well, if this isn't who I am, if this doesn't bring me joy, I'll just go to the next thing. And I'll keep redefining myself over and over again. It is exhausting. I think there's a few identities that we try to embrace, especially here in the metro Atlanta suburbs. This kind of Christian fried, strange soup that we live in. I think one is this identity that we embrace is that I'm in control. God is, I am who I am, and we would answer back, well, but I am in control. That's who I am. And then we realize that's not true. And we realize more and more through life that we're actually not in control. There's all sorts of things that we don't control. And that makes us either very anxious because we realize all of this stuff is outside of my control, but I'm supposed to be the one who's in control, or it makes us very angry and we blame other people around us. And God's saying, no, if you would let me define you, I am who I am. If you would let me walk with you, there's a different way. Some of us define ourselves like this: I am what I own. My stack is bigger. My car is faster. My house is better. And that starts to define me. Then either we don't obtain the things that we're after, and so that just leads us into a depression because we've latched our identities onto things that shift and change, or we just have tons of debt. Welcome to Cobb County. Maybe we define our identity like this: I am who I have sex with, or I am who I am in a relationship with. And that identity just pushes us into dependency on a person, another person that's not healthy. Or when that relationship is unfulfilling, we just move on to promiscuity. Or perhaps we define ourselves like this: I am what I produce, what I can make, what I can do. I can get more done in less time. I'm more efficient than Waze. I promise I can get you there faster. And that just leads us to exhaustion because we're constantly trying to keep up. Here's the good news, though. There's another way. There's another path. we could embrace a different identity. This identity. I am who I am says I am. I am who I am. Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am who I am says that I am. I don't need control, although I might fight for it sometimes. I'm not defined by what I produce, although I might take joy in it sometimes. I'm not what I own, and I am not who I'm in a relationship with. I'm defined by something bigger, this God of fire. I am Yahweh. You notice something strange in this passage? Because it sounds good, but it's like, how does it happen? Here's what's strange here. This is the first time the word holy is used in the entire Bible. It means set apart, different. Moses, did you notice this? Walks onto holy ground. God doesn't say, don't come any closer or you will be on holy ground. He gets there and God says, take off your sandals because you are on holy ground. And so out of a sign of respect, Moses takes off his sandals. And then he starts to interact with the angel of God. The word angel just means a messenger in Hebrew. So a messenger from God. But this weird thing happens. Two weird things, really. The first one is, sometimes the text says the angel of God, and sometimes it says God is the one who's speaking. Well, what's going on there? And then Moses, in one sentence, in one verse, is terrified and hides his face, and then in the very next verse, he's saying, hey, I got some problems here. Now, who in their right mind would be standing in the fatal zone, so to speak, that close to the presence of God, speaking with this angel, mysterious, maybe it's God, what's going on there, and start complaining? What is happening? See, I think that's actually what the text wants us to see. Is that Moses is this close to the presence of God, but there's someone mediating on his behalf. There's someone extending grace to him, even though he doesn't deserve it in the moment. There's someone actively forgiving him, even though he's acting like a whiny punk in the very presence of God. And that someone is Jesus. See, all throughout the Old Testament, we meet all sorts of angels, but occasionally we meet the angel of the Lord. And that angel of the Lord is a manifestation, the physical presence of God himself, who is the second person of the Trinity, Jesus the Son. And who Moses is interacting with in the burning bush is Jesus. And you go, Brandon, this seems a little crazy. Are you sure? I'm positive. See, because Jesus in John chapter 8 is interacting with some Pharisees, and they've got all sorts of questions for him, and they're accusing him of all sorts of things, and they want to know where he came from and who sent him and under what authority he speaks on behalf of God. And in John 8, verse 58, Jesus responds, and Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. There you go. Maybe he's just saying he's old. Maybe Jesus is just like, yeah, man, I'm a few thousand years old. I existed before Abraham. And everybody would be like, bro, you're crazy. You don't look that old. It's amazing. You moisturize? Right? Like, unbelievable. But that's not the way they respond. They respond in verse 39. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. You know what they heard? They heard Exodus chapter 3. When Jesus says to those Pharisees and religious leaders, I am, he's saying, you remember Exodus 3, the bush, Yahweh, when God says, I am who I am? Yeah, that's me. That was me in the bush. And this is me, God in person, standing before you. Which is why John in chapter 1 says that Jesus came full of grace and truth. He came as a fire. Grace inviting, forgiving, longing to extend a relationship. Also truth. Never backing down on what is true. And Jesus didn't come as a balance, half and half full, all of those. That Jesus is the God of fire. That Jesus is I am. That Jesus was in the bush in Exodus chapter 3. And the reason that Moses wasn't consumed in that moment is because Jesus was there. And that's the hope that you and I have. That we come boldly to this God. That we can come seeking for God to define us and call us and shape us and mold us, not because of our own merit, not because of a laundry list of successes, not because we attend church faithfully every week, not because we lead a Bible study, but because Jesus stands in our place for us. See, this passage points us to the gospel. That Jesus, God in person, came and died on a cross for us in our place. And that Jesus rose from the dead, proving that he is God. And it is Jesus who is our mediator. It's Jesus. You see, all spiritual encounters begin and end with Jesus. So then maybe the question is this, well, why don't I experience this? Why don't I experience this fire? Why do I not feel like I'm being defined by God? Why do I not have this kind of experience like Moses? Why don't I know Jesus like that? See, because spiritual encounters with God most often happen on detours. See, God works on the back roads, not on the highways. And the reason that most of us don't have a letter stitched in our coat pocket like Blaise Pascal, and the reason this passage seems so absolutely foreign to us, is because we are working so hard to live the fast track. We are striving so much and putting our identities in everything around us. We are trying to produce more. We're trying to own more. We're trying to control more. We're trying to sleep with more people. We're trying to get on the interstate, and we don't realize God's on the back road. That sometimes the macro detours of our lives and the micro detours of our days is where God shows up. Slow down. This is for me. We have to slow down. We have to take a break. We have to be drawn in. We have to be willing to set aside some time to take the detour. If you want a God to define who you are, it has to start with some time in His Word and in prayer. We have to hear from Him. Which means we have to shut off other sources and messages. I want you to receive this the way I intend it. Sometimes you do need a new job. But sometimes that's a detour. Sometimes you do need a new counselor. But sometimes that's a detour. Sometimes you do need a new family doctor. Sometimes that's a detour. Sometimes you might need a new girlfriend or boyfriend. But sometimes the heartache you're experiencing right now is a detour. It's a back road. Sometimes you might feel like you need a new spouse. But the reality is that just might be where God's showing up. I know. I don't feel like I have friends. My family's a wreck. My health is all over the place. I am not saying don't do the best you can. Make the best decisions you can. I'm just saying be aware that might be a detour, a spiritual encounter, something God is using to draw you to Himself, to show you who He is, and to call you into something different, like what we find in Exodus chapter 3. Now, for some of us today, the reality is this is foreign because we just don't know Christ. We don't know who Jesus is. We've heard stories about him. We've been around him. But we just aren't sure who he is. And the good news of the scriptures is that Jesus, that I am, this fire of God who came in grace and truth, wants to extend grace to you. And he's invited you into a relationship with God through knowing him, through placing your faith in him. And my prayer for you today is if you don't know Jesus, that you would come to know him, that you would allow him to define who you are. And then some of us who are followers of Jesus, today what we need to do is just slow down. Take some time. Allow our curiosity or our need to draw us into the presence of God. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you so much for the truth we find in your word. Father, that you are full of grace and truth. That you are simultaneously both judge and full of mercy. Father, that you are the law and forgiving. And Father, may we experience forgiveness, grace, and truth through your Son, Jesus. May that shape who we are. Father, I pray for my folks here today, my people that you've graciously given to me. God, I just pray that you would help them to slow down, to listen, to look for you, to search for you in the scripture, to know your heart in prayer. Father, I pray that you would convict us of how we're trying to define ourselves. And could we put ourselves humbly under your authority? Could we be who you say that we are? Pray in Jesus' name, amen. So you guys stand and worship with us.